In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about China. And our guest for the show is Gordon Chang. He's lived and worked in China for almost 2 decades, most recently in Shanghai as a counsel to an American law firm, the firm of Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton, and Garrison. He's written articles on China that have been published in a number of different places, including the New York Times, the Asian Wall Street Journal, the Far Eastern Economic Review, the International Herald Tribune, and the South China Morning Post. And he makes his home in Shanghai. He's also the author of a recently published book, which is titled The Coming Collapse of China. It's published by Random House, in which he makes the argument that although the economy of China might indeed appear to be robust on the surface, and for a while it was one of the fastest growing economies in the world. In fact, some people predicted that within the next decade it could be the world's biggest economy. He says that, in fact, that appearances can be deceiving and that underneath conditions are very, very different. And for a variety of reasons that we'll explore today, he says that within the next 5, perhaps 10 years, there is a real possibility of significant collapse in China, particularly as the government of China faces greater pressure, both economic and perhaps we might say philosophic pressure from dissidents within and around China. And all of this, he goes into all of this in some detail in the book. So if you're interested, it's out in bookstores. And, of course, this morning we'll have a conversation, and if you have comments or questions, all you need to do is pick up the telephone and dial the number. You can be a part of the show. All we ask is people just try to be brief so we can get in as many people as possible. But anybody can call 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, here locally, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILO. Mr. Chang, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
I think probably anybody who writes a book that forecasts the coming collapse of anything, particularly if it's something big, is going to get a lot of static, I suppose.
Well, certainly, because today the world's consensus about China is that it's got the right mode for development and that it only has a glorious future. So to a certain extent, you're right. There is some static.
Well, tell me a little bit about your experience in China and how much time have you had the opportunity to spend there and sort of in what capacity?
Well, my wife and I started living in Shanghai in August of 96. And as you mentioned, we were practicing law. Before that, we were in California for 5 years and were traveling to Shanghai regularly. At one point, we were coming to China once every 6 weeks, and that got a little tiring, so we actually moved there. And before that, I was in Hong Kong for 10 years. And then during that point, I was going up into China as well. But for the last 5 years, we have seen China very close and very personal. And that was the reason why I wrote the book, because I saw that the analyses that were being done about the country, especially by foreigners, just really weren't hitting the mark.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is the difference that you have had the opportunity to talk with people in a way where they're actually telling you what they really think?
Well, it was that, of course. But what really got me going was that living in Shanghai, which is a wonderful city, in the last 10 years, there's tremendous development. And many foreigners come in and they see that and they say, well, the country's leaders really understand what to do. It's a very modern place, et cetera, et cetera. But when you live there, you realize that the city is being developed by central government money. They're just pouring money in. It's almost as if they found a city and they decided to rebuild it, which is exactly what they've done. But what you don't have is sustainable development. What you have is central government supporting Shanghai to the tune of billions and billions of dollars a year. If you live there, you can see that. But if you just come in, it's much more difficult to discern.
And I think one of the central arguments that you're making in the book is that in a way that represents the economy as a whole, and that if indeed the time comes when China truly opens, and maybe the key here is admission to the World Trade Organization and has to really deal with competition from outside, that's, you feel that that's the thing that's the proverbial tipping point here?
Exactly. What we have is the techniques that were used to develop Shanghai were the same that were used to develop heavy industry in the early 1950s, and we ended up with state-owned enterprises, which are the backbone of Chinese industry, but they're completely unsustainable and uncompetitive, even in China's highly protected environment. The central government is using the same techniques to develop high tech and everything else. And the point is that even though the country looks more modern these days, the government still is using the old Maoist centrally directed model of development, which is proven not to work not only in China itself, but around the world. When China joins the World Trade Organization, the ability of the central government to continually defer solutions to problems will be limited. And in the enhanced competition that China will face in its own markets, I just don't think that the state-owned enterprises and the state-owned banks will be able to hold up.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Gordon Chang, author of the book The Coming Collapse of China. It's published by Random House. Just one thing I would like to mention here, because it's a story that we certainly have been following here in the state of Illinois, and the news has just come in. Democrats will be able to break the tie in the process of redrawing the state's legislative boundaries. The Illinois Secretary of State, Jesse White, drew retired Supreme Court Justice Michael Blandick's name from an Abe Lincoln-type stovepipe hat this morning in the state capitol in Springfield. Blandick and retired Republican Justice Ben Miller were the two candidates to join the eight-member commission that has deadlocked on the remap. And here we're talking about within the state legislature, those districts. The drawing of Blandick's name will give the Democrats a 5-4 advantage, meaning they will control the outcome of the remap, although there is a lawsuit involving this, and it's likely that this story is not just going to stop there. But for the moment, that's where things stand with the Democrats on top. I'm sure we will have more later on in our newscast here on AM 580 throughout the day, so you want to stay with us as we follow along that story. And also, as we talk this morning here with Gordon Chang, all you have to do is call in if you'd like to ask a question, make a comment, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. What really is the base of the Chinese economy? What does it really rest on?
Well, these days it rests on the state-owned enterprises, which are mainly the heavy industries. Increasingly, the private entrepreneurs are becoming more and more a part of the economy, which is a good thing because their enterprises are much more productive, they're much more flexible and nimble, and they've been gaining ground on the state-owned enterprises. But still, that's where the main part of Chinese industry is these days.
And do these are they profitable? Do they make money? On paper, it's as you explained in the book. On paper, they do, but in fact, do they?
I don't think so. Chinese accounting is so loose that they can make anything appear profitable. These days, the central government claims that state-owned enterprises, on the whole, are profitable. But you have to look a little bit behind the numbers because, for instance, the central government doesn't count all the subsidies it gives to state-owned enterprises when it comes and determines profitability. But as I point out in the book, it's really not profitability that matters in the World Trade Organization. It's competitiveness. And Chinese enterprises, although they've been dressed up recently, they still are not competitive. And that means that when the foreign multinationals are able to compete on a more equal footing, then clearly the state enterprises are going to fail in even greater numbers than they do today.
Mm-hmm. For a long time, I think one of the things that the Chinese government would assert as being one of its great achievements was guaranteeing everybody a job for lifetime. And it's the proverbial iron rice bowl was the old phrase that was used for that. And it's something that it's not the case anymore. What sort of unemployment is there now in China?
The central government, and this just gives you a sense of how out of touch they are, they say that from 1997 through the year 2000, the last year for which figures are available, the rate of urban unemployment was 3.1%. Now, this was a period of rising unemployment. Clearly, it couldn't be 3.1%. Most experts think it's in the 15-20% neighborhood. Some say a little bit more, some a little bit less, but we're talking about a number in that range. In some of the northeastern provinces, which are China's Rust Belt, unemployment in the major cities can be somewhere between 25-30%. So that clearly is a problem for the regime.
And are there people that you would say perhaps are employed but marginally?
There is underemployment. It is a major problem. The statistics on this are very difficult because China is a hostile place for the statistician. But many people say that if you total all of the unemployed and the underemployed, you get a number which is in the 200 million range, which is quite significant. To give you some perspective, you could take the entire population of England, France, and Germany, and it would still be less than the number of unemployed and underemployed in China today.
We have several callers, so let's start bringing people into the conversation. They're all in Urbana, so we'll take them in the order they came in, starting with line one right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a good friend who was very active during the Tiananmen Square incident. And as a matter of fact, he's persona non grata back in China now. But he tells me that there's a Chinese individual whose last name is Chang also, who's in a prison in Toronto because his smuggling activities, apparently smuggling legal goods, not drugs or anything like that, has reached the highest levels of the Chinese government, including the head of their counterpart to the KGB and also some of Jiang Zemin's children. Are you familiar with this individual?
That's the famous Mr. Lai, and he, I think, is in Vancouver, unless he's been transferred in the last week. He is involved in at the heart of the Xiamen smuggling scandal, which certainly has rocked China because it's considered to be the largest of its kind. The problem is that a very, very senior Communist Party cadre is involved, and he and especially his wife have been protected because they are supporters of Jiang Zemin, who is the general secretary of the party, the number one person in China. I don't think it's Jiang Zemin's son himself, but clearly the scandal does reach two very important supporters of the general secretary. And so this is something which has really been on the lips of the Chinese population for quite some time because the smuggling ring was so pervasive, reaching all the way to the upper levels of Beijing.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. We'll go on to another Urbana person. This is line two. Hello.
Yes. Good morning. Mm-hmm. I had a question which I would like to defer for 1 minute while I ask you to please amplify your answer to the other caller's question. When you say smuggling, do you mean Western goods into China or Chinese goods elsewhere?
The smuggling was imports into China, and they varied all the way from just regular luxury goods or whatever to oil. I'd imagine that most of the volume of smuggled goods was probably petroleum products coming into China. But clearly the ring covered the range of goods that are brought into China.
Okay, thank you. Concerning my question, you talked about the fact that China would not be able to compete with other multinational companies, and that I wondered what exactly is the process, what are the steps that you see China faltering on if it were to have to compete with other multinationals. And then my second question is, should multinationals be running the world economy, and should a country not be able to have an impact greater than the multinational countries?
Okay, the first
multinational companies.
Yeah, the first question is the multinationals sell products throughout China today, but they're severely hampered by a number of things. One of them is high tariffs, and second of all, many internal barriers to trade that prevent them from distributing their goods in an efficient manner. What happens in WTO is these barriers, tariff and non-tariff barriers, fall, and that means that multinationals will be able to really penetrate the Chinese market in a way that hasn't happened up to this point. And because of that, I see many of the state-owned enterprises as failing because they just will not be able to deliver goods at the same cost and at the same quality as foreign companies will. So therefore, they'll fail, you'll have unemployment, and you could have, as we have today, civil unrest in the urban areas. The same process will take place in the countryside as well. Most people think that agriculture will be the hardest hit sector of the Chinese economy. As to the second part of your question, that goes well beyond China and goes to just issues of globalization. Everybody has their own opinion on that. Mine is not particularly better than anybody else's. So I think I might defer that one, just except to say that globalization, for both good and bad, is inevitable. And so therefore, whether we like it or not, it will occur. For people who feel that there are problems with the way things are going, it's very important to try to mitigate some of the worst aspects of that. But at the end of the day, it is inevitable because people do like to buy cheaper goods, and that's what happens when you have globalization. So there is a strong support, I think, among many people that this process should continue.
Well, I have another question, which is when I buy things for the past 8 or 10 years, I have been astonished that every time I look at where it was made, it comes from China. So if China is so ubiquitous as a exporting country, why should it be hurt since they seem to make the cheapest goods around? Why would they be hurt if they joined World Trade Organization?
Well, today China enjoys one-way trade with the world. America, for instance, buys a lot of Chinese goods but doesn't export that many to China. What happens in the World Trade Organization, China has to open up its markets, so there'll be two-way trade. And that means that enterprises that are barely surviving today just will fail. Today we already have wide-scale unrest in urban areas as it is. In the future, when the central government will not be able to control the worst effects of increased competition, more enterprises should fail. And some experts think that if you look at the 1,100 companies whose stock is publicly traded in the domestic stock markets in China, only a handful of those will survive WTO accession. Well, I don't know if it's going to be that bad, but clearly the shakeout of China's best companies will be horrendous. When you look at China's worst companies, the ones that aren't traded on public stock exchanges, the effects will probably be even worse.
Would you give me your opinion on whether governments should be able to have a greater impact on its population than these transnational companies?
Well, governments, any government can limit multinational companies. The one process that you see, and this is in general, this is not just China, governments are subject to lobbying from the multinationals. And it's not just corporate lobbyists in Gucci shoes, as the saying goes. It's workers and farmers who are able to sell abroad who are benefited by freer trade. So there are many, many people who are on the side of globalization one way or another. If governments want to stop global trade, they certainly can do that, but they've got to deal with their own populations first. These issues are extremely complex, going from highly sophisticated economic questions to some very simple pocketbook issues. And so these types of questions won't be settled for this year or decades to come as people continue to discuss the benefits and the disadvantages of globalization.
Thank you.
All right. We're almost in our midpoint here, and I'd just like to introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Gordon Chang. He's lived and worked in China for almost 2 decades, most recently in Shanghai as a counsel to an American law firm. He's written articles on China that have appeared in a number of places, including the New York Times, the Asian Wall Street Journal, the Far Eastern Economic Review. He is author of a recent book that's titled The Coming Collapse of China. It's published by Random House, is in bookstores now, if you're interested. And we are certainly interested in having your comments and questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, any place the signal will travel, 800-222-9455. And another Urbana person. This is line three. Hello.
Hi. I've got two questions. One is if Mr. Chang has gotten in trouble with the government for writing a book that doesn't depict a rosy future or a rosy present. I'd ask that question first.
Well, not in trouble yet, because my wife and I moved to the U.S. temporarily in connection with the release of the book. What we intend to do is reapply for visas after the end of our book tour, and then we'll see whether we're in trouble or not, whether we'll be able to get back in. And also, even if we're able to get back in, if we think that we'd have difficulties, we certainly wouldn't go there. We would probably end up in Hong Kong. So that really remains to be seen and is a major issue in my life, at least.
Yeah. My other question is about ethnic tensions and secessionist groups. And is that overplayed in the media, or is that something that's growing stronger? And is China going to fall apart into regions more than, or in addition to economically, or what do you think about that?
The ethnic tensions are the worst in Tibet and Xinjiang province. And Xinjiang province are where the Muslims are. The ethnic tensions in Xinjiang are underplayed in the media because we just don't know that much about it. The government is very effective in censoring the news that comes out of Xinjiang. In Tibet, the world pretty much knows what's going on and I think has a fairly accurate view, largely because the Dalai Lama has been such an effective spokesman for the Tibetans. The ethnic tensions are important in China, but neither ethnic group will be able to overthrow the government or to win its independence in the immediate future. What they are important for is that they distract the government from very critical economic problems. So instead of dealing with state-owned enterprises or whatever, the government chases after Tibetans and Uyghurs, who are the Muslims. And that's a real problem.
Okay, thank you.
All right. You, Mr. Tang, you talked earlier. Also, you said that there had been widespread unrest in urban areas. Just what sort of form does that unrest take?
Well, just to give you a good example, in February of 2000, 20,000 workers and 2,000 of their relatives rioted upon the closure of a mine about 250 miles northeast of Beijing, and largely because, not because the mine closed, but because officials at the mine were not paying the proper severance. Basically, they were corrupt and putting the money in their own pockets. So you have demonstrations like this around the country. The number of demonstrations were quite large. In 1999, about 100,000 demonstrations, according to the Ministry of Public Security. We really don't know how many there were in the year 2000, but we do know the demonstrations have been getting bigger. And it's not just bigger in the countryside, in the city, but also in the countryside as well. The other aspect of these demonstrations, which is frightening, is not their number or their size, but it's just the desperation of people, because we have urban workers or peasants taking on the security forces of the state, even though the demonstrators are barehanded and the security forces of the state are armed. So that tells us a lot about the state of what's happening in China today.
Is there anyone who still is willing to speak in support of the government?
Well, there are many people who are willing to speak in support of the government. The government has many friends, and many people support the Chinese state just because it's inconceivable to them that it could fall. Hmm. Many people just want to make a quick buck, so you see that on the part of the multinationals. You especially see it on the part of the investment banks that want to underwrite Chinese securities in international markets. So I would say that apart from isolated dissident communities around the world, most people, one way or another, do support the state.
Perhaps we talked a little bit about discontent based on nationalism and the feelings of Tibetans and the Uyghurs who live in Xinjiang. Also in the book, you talk a little bit about Falun Gong, and certainly it has gotten some attention in Western media, although I'm not sure that Westerners particularly understand what Falun Gong is about. The numbers are a little bit hard to get a handle on. The Falun Gong folks will give you one number, and then the Chinese will say, oh, no, this is just a little tiny movement. It's no big deal. So they wanted to downplay it. But it seems that maybe the most significant thing about this is how willing the practitioners of Falun Gong have been to publicly make display of their feelings and have really taken on the government in a very open and public way.
You're absolutely right. The most important thing about the Falun Gong is not that they present an organized challenge to the central government, but really because they provide inspiration to other groups in society. The Falun Gong will never be able to topple the government, but what they do is they provide hope for other people in society who do have that power, namely the workers and the peasants, because the Falun Gong practitioners have been utterly defiant of the government, not only demonstrating in Tiananmen Square, but also taking their own lives. So it has been a very, very difficult episode for the central government to deal with this group, which has proven to be remarkably resilient, even in the face of increasing harsh crackdowns.
It's something, I didn't realize this is sort of jumping to another topic, but it is something that has been in the news a little bit lately. I'm interested in your thought about it, and that is the problem of AIDS in China. It's something that for a long time I think the government refused really even to acknowledge that it was a problem. And finally, earlier this summer, the health ministry said that there were 600,000 Chinese people who were infected. The estimates, United Nations has estimated that it could be more like a million, and that it is indeed a significant problem and will grow more significant. How much of a problem do you think this is now and will be in the future?
Well, it is a greater problem now than it needed to be, because the government, just as you mentioned, refused to acknowledge the problem, and because they refused to acknowledge it, they weren't dealing with it. One of the traits of the Communist Party, and this goes all the way back to the founding of the People's Republic, is the inability to deal with difficult issues, especially when those issues point out failures of the government itself. So it goes back all the way to the Great Leap Forward, when tens of millions of people died, many of them needlessly, because the granaries were full with past harvests. The party couldn't take the grain out of storage because they couldn't acknowledge that their policies were failing. It's the same thing with AIDS, only on a smaller scale, in that this has been a problem that Western experts have known about for quite some time, and the Chinese government just refused to deal with it in any organized manner. Now it's only belatedly coming to some sort of an acknowledgement that it's an issue which faces China. It certainly becomes serious when you have people who are completely desperate and have no hope, and that's AIDS sufferers certainly fall within that category. So it's not inconceivable that you will have people who just have no hope for the future just completely angry with their government, and that's a problem. The world organizations see that by 2010 there could be 10 million AIDS sufferers. In a population of 1.4 billion, that doesn't sound too much, but even that number might be underplayed. The problem with China is that we just don't know. And it's not that we don't know as foreigners. The problem is that the authorities in China don't know. So if they don't know about the problem or the extent of it, they can't adequately deal with it.
We'll go back here to the telephone again for a caller in Peoria, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning. China is having the same problem that Japan has. Japan is $6.5 billion in debt, and they can't sell the merchandise because one reason is a lot of Americans are out of work or nearly out of work.
Well, Mr. Cheng, you want to talk about the debt situation? That's something that you also write a good deal about, I think, in the book.
Yeah, China's debt on the surface doesn't look too bad, but if you add in all the hidden obligations, China has substantial debt. The problem here, and the reason why the debt issue is important for China, is that today the central government keeps the economy going through massive fiscal stimulus, which means that not only that China has more roads, but it has ever-increasing budget deficits. As the caller points out, Japan is having trouble selling its goods around the world because of economic slowdown. That slowdown is bound to get worse, and it'll affect China more than Japan, because these days China depends for its increases in its gross domestic product, or its economic growth, almost entirely through an increase in exports. And I don't even think the Chinese authorities think that they can increase their exports over what looks to be a very, very difficult economic situation around the world.
One thing that seems to have been continues to be very important to the Chinese government in terms of social control, and that is control of the access of Chinese people to information, to news and to outside information. It's my understanding that China is on the verge of making an agreement with News Corp and AOL Time Warner that would allow them to broadcast directly television to some parts in southern China. And while one might say that we're not really talking about very many people here, it is apparently indeed very significant if it happens at all, because the government has been so concerned about maintaining control over television. We know that there is internet in China, and a lot of people had made predictions about it as a democratizing force. Once you get that, it's really much, much harder to keep the lid on what people can look at, what information they can get to, how they can exchange information. Does the opening up of communications, how significant, how much of that opening has there been, and how significant is that?
Well, there has been a significant opening up of communications, especially if you look back at what China was like before the reform era began in 1978. So today there are something like 23 million internet accounts. That number is subject to some dispute, but clearly the number has been growing over the last few years. The number of mobile phones in China supposedly surpassed those in the United States last month. There is more television. There are more direct satellite dishes all over the town. All over the country. And the important thing, though, it's not so much the foreign websites and the foreign media, though that of important, of course, but it's also the Chinese talking to themselves, one to the next. The reason why the regime has been able to stay in power is that although there are many people who don't like it, they have not been able to band together and act as one. And so the significant aspect of increased communication in China will be Chinese talking to themselves. And we've seen examples of this as news spreads around China, as people spread rumors along the internet, all sorts of things can happen. In 1989, at the Tiananmen Square demonstrations, many people did not know about that in China and did not know what happened just because of the poor state of communications. And even around the world, we didn't hear too much because CNN was cut off and because many times the only way that the demonstrators could communicate with the outside world was through fax machines, and there just weren't that many machines at that time. Today, you have so many ways for people in China to contact people outside, and you have so many ways for people outside to contact people in China. So, you know, people there have a much better idea of what's going on in the world, even though the news is highly censored. But as I mentioned, as the Chinese talk more and more among themselves, as they talk more with people in the outside world, they get a better sense of what's happening, and that inevitably gives them a sense that they could have a better government, they could have a freer system, and that is the ultimate subversive effect of communications.
We have just a bit more than 10 minutes in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Gordon Chang. He is an attorney. He's lived and worked in China for almost two decades, most recently in Shanghai as a counsel for an American law firm. He's also written articles on China for New York Times, Asian Wall Street Journal, Far Eastern Economic Review, among others, and is now in the United States to talk about his book, The Coming Collapse of China. It's published by Random House. Should be available in the bookstore if you want to look at it. Questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Martinsville, line 4. Hello.
Yes, hi. I was in Harbin not long ago, and speaking of the communications issue, I was in private homes. I saw BBC and two or three different places, so I know that information is available. I went to cyber cafes, cyber bars, for email access. And, of course, the hotels had different things. China Cable News, which is a knockoff of CNN, sure looks like CNN, but you could tell it was government-sponsored. One of the things we're having difficulty with is exporting equipment to China, and they have kind of hypocrisy about how they do things. They can bring things in from Russia that we can't, as far as bringing from the United States, and they turn a blind eye to that. Do you have anything to say about the import situation?
Well, as I mentioned before, China has basically had one-way trade with the world, and it's been able very much to control what happens because up to now, the central government has been able to essentially set the rules of the game, and it referees the game, so it pretty much gets the results it desires. But when China joins the World Trade Organization, its ability to do that will be limited. In terms of Harbin and the trade across the border, especially with the Siberian parts of Russia, you probably know much more about that than I do, but clearly there's a lot of trade that goes on, some of it government-sanctioned and much of it that isn't. And I think that your problems in terms of selling into China, you're facing local protectionism and a little bit of problems in that regard. One of the things that WTO will do is it will permit you to sell because many of the rules that the bureaucrats now enforce will be eliminated. Of course, there'll be cheating in the future as bureaucrats and local party officials try to protect local industry, but eventually foreign business will prevail. So you should have an easier time of it, if not next year, then maybe two or three years down the road.
How strict are the Chinese on tax situations as far as applying sanctions to the local business people?
The state tax authorities over the last couple of years have certainly cracked down on tax evasion, and it's not only the foreigners but also private entrepreneurs, the domestic private entrepreneurs. They're doing that for a number of reasons, largely because they want to try to level the income distribution in the country, because the disparity between rich and poor has gotten too great, and also because everybody acknowledges that China doesn't collect enough revenue. I think that in the coming years, China will be increasingly effective in trying to collect revenue. But one of the things that membership in the World Trade Organization will do is it will permit foreign business to avoid some of the discriminatory practices that now exist, because WTO requires fair treatment for everybody, both foreign and domestic.
Well, I know that outside companies try to put one layer of insulation between them and the actual Chinese business they're doing by having a Chinese partner. And that way, if there's a discrepancy or problem, the Chinese guy goes to jail instead of the Westerners. And I know that Case New Holland lost a dealer not long ago for tax problems, and they said, we keep a pretty close eye on our dealers, and we don't think there's anything to it. But there was some other political agenda in place is the reason that he was shut down.
Yes, well, up to now, foreign business has been required, in most instances, to have a local joint venture partner. That's one of the things that will go by the boards when China joins the global trading body. So it should get a little bit easier. The authorities have much more control over the local partner than they do the foreigner. And also, for various reasons, Chinese over the last couple hundred years have treated foreigners very different than they treat their own people. But, you know, we'll see those trends start to change as China grows up and really enters into the world community more than it has in the past.
Okay, I'll let someone else come on. Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's go to Charleston here, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I have a couple of questions, if I may. First of all, is there much democracy at the village level in China? That is, do the villages elect their own leaders in the villages?
Secondly, that's an excellent question. China has a law which requires grassroots village elections, and in many places in China they do. And in some of those places, the elections are effective and fair. In many other places, though, especially where the local Communist Party cadres are especially corrupt, the village elections don't really mean that much. And in some places, they don't even hold village elections at all. The real issue about these village elections is whether they'll spread to the township level and spread to the cities. The problem here is that the political process, especially under Jiang Zemin, the current General Party Secretary and President, the political process has really frozen for the last 5 years or so. So there hasn't been any real further development in democratization at the village level or at any other level.
Mm. Okay, and my second question is completely different topic. I wondered about the around China's borders with Russia, with Indochina, with Outer Mongolia and so on. There must be kinship lines and kinship groups that cross those borders. I was wondering how important they are to China's foreign policy with regard to those nations.
Very important. The most important issue for Chinese foreign policy is Taiwan and getting Taiwan back into under mainland control. That is the number one issue. The number two issue would be what you mentioned, the various matters that China has with its other neighbors, especially with the Muslims in northwest China. Those Uyghurs are not only on the Chinese side of the border, but they're on the other sides of various borders that China has. So that's a problem. The ethnic tensions with Indochina are not that great because you generally have Vietnamese on one side and Chinese on the other. With regard to Russia, it's the Russians who worry, not the Chinese, because they're concerned that with population pressure on the Chinese side, that the Chinese will just overwhelm the far eastern parts of Russia. So it's a matter that the Chinese don't consider a problem, but that the Russians do.
Okay, and if I may, I have one more quick one, and that is 1.3 billion population. It must be extremely difficult to enforce laws. I was wondering about, they passed laws saying no cars in Beijing. Do they have enough jails to arrest everybody? No bicycles, who would ride a bicycle anyway? How do they enforce laws over 1.3 billion people? I'm thinking particularly of Mao Zedong telling Henry Kissinger he had only changed a little area around Beijing.
Yes, the central government is effective in enforcing laws in the Beijing municipality. But as you point out, and it's a very perceptive comment, in many other parts of the country, the central government is no more effective than the Qing dynasty, which preceded the Chiang Kai-shek, who himself had very little control over many parts of China. It's a constant theme. It's not just a problem with today's China. It's been a problem with China going back thousands and thousands of years. It's made particularly worse because local Chinese party cadres at the very lowest level, their salaries are not paid by the central government, so they don't really pay much attention to the central government except for issues of extreme national importance. So, for instance, when the central government wants to prosecute Falun Gong practitioners, the central government pretty much gets its way even at the local level. But when it comes to other issues, the local Chinese party cadres, they just sometimes thumb their noses at Beijing and do what they want to do.
We're down to the point here where we have maybe about 3 minutes, and I realize that predicting the future is difficult, if not impossible. But if I ask the question, so you know, tell me what you think the likely scenario would be for the next, say, 5 years in China. What would you say?
I would see, especially towards the latter part of that 5-year period, growing economic unrest leading to economic collapse. Either in that 5-year period or just shortly afterwards, you'd see a political collapse as well. In other words, the Chinese Communist Party would no longer rule China. You have a period of uncertainty, maybe even chaos, as there's a vacuum created. This has happened in many times in Chinese history, and I expect that it will happen within a fairly short time frame.
Mm. Well, given the fact that I would expect that the ripples, maybe tidal waves that would be felt in the world economy from a collapse of economy this size would not be good, and we wouldn't want to experience it here in the United States or to see the world experience it. Is there something that you would say that the United States could be doing to forestall that collapse?
Well, I'm not sure that we could do very much to forestall any trend in China. I think it's extremely important for the American government to make it clear to the Chinese people that we engage them, not just their government, because when the party does fall, we do not want to be shut out of China. We don't want the Chinese people to think that we were the friend only of their government, not of them. And of course, that happened in Iran in the 1970s as Washington embraced the Shah. And when the Shah was gone, the Iranian people remembered that we supported a hated dictator. And to this day, we have been shut out of Iran. You know, Iran is small and China is large, so the consequences would be so much more severe the next time.
Mm-hmm. We'll try to squeeze one more caller here. Chicago, line four.
Thank you. You talk about the collapse of China. Well, there's something that's afoot in the world financial markets called derivatives, and I understand over $150 trillion is invested in. And our Federal Reserve Chairman, Alan Greenspan, tried to shore things up with the recent collapse in Indonesia and other areas. Do you see a collapse occurring in the world economy as well?
No, because to a large extent, China has up to now at least walled itself off with currency controls, which will survive the WTO era. The real problem will be that China makes much of what the world takes. And so the United States is going to have to scramble to buy shoes from Bangladesh instead of from China. And other countries will have to do the same thing. But that's not such a major problem at the end of the day. The real problem with China falling will not be economic, but will be the fallout from any struggle with Taiwan, for instance, which would inevitably involve the United States. China is a nuclear power, and we were very lucky when the Soviet Union collapsed. But I'm not so sure that we're going to be as lucky when China collapses.
We will have to stop there because we're at the end of the time. The guest this morning, Gordon Chang, the book, if you'd like to read it, The Coming Collapse of China, published by Random House. Mr. Chang, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.